Good morning, Reality Church. How are you guys doing this morning? Doing all right? Yeah, I'm doing all right. My name is Lance Birch. I'm one of the pastors here at Reality Church, and so glad you made the choice to be here. If this is your first time, we're so glad that you're here, but you did miss an incredible musical last week, so that should have been your first week. Yeah. Yeah. Give it up for those kids. They were amazing. I don't know if you guys know this, but last week we had 920 people here come to Reality Church. That's our second highest attendance for the whole year, so that was pretty amazing. And maybe you came and you're back, and so glad that you are checking out our church, and we want to get you any information that you want to have. I'm glad that you're here today, though, because today we're going to talk about kind of what we've been talking about for the first 8 weeks of this series, how every time you read the Bible, you read the Old Testament anyway, you see these like superhuman hero type people. And if you're in church for any length of time, eventually you just start feeling inadequate. You look at their stories and you go, wait, I could never be that super spiritual. I could never be, you know, that kind of hero. I'm just not that person. And the good news is neither were they. Everyone that you read about in the Old Testament, every story of each supposed hero has a deeply flawed person in the middle of it, a deeply scarred person, a person who has their own struggles, their own temptations, their own sins. They just aren't that supernatural. See, if you were to ask me as a kid what the Old Testament was about, you know, I grew up VBS, I went to church a long time, and if you were to ask me what the Old Testament was about, I would say it's about these really superheroes, these superhero guys and girls, and I'm supposed to emulate them. I'm supposed to be like Moses, you know, and follow God's law or deliver the truth to people. Or I'm supposed to be like David and slay the giant. I'm supposed to have the courage to go down there in the valley and beat Goliath. I need to be like David. Or I need to dare to be a Daniel and stand up when everything's going against me. I need to dare to be like those guys. And they were the heroes of all these stories. But the truth is, if you really read the Old Testament, you'll see that the Old Testament is not about what these guys did. It's about what God did through a bunch of flawed, scared, scarred people. And so it's not their story. It's God's story. And God is the hero all the way through the Bible. All the way through. The Old Testament to the New Testament, God is telling this huge story. He's writing a play. He's making a movie. He's illustrating who he is. And he's using us to do it. And so if you get that wrong, a lot of my church background was revolving around what we called getting the blessing of God on our life. The blessing of God was something really important when I was growing up. It meant that God's favor was on you. So if you behaved yourself, if you did the right stuff, you know, and for me, it was growing up in the student ministry, it was a pretty short list. You know, don't drink, don't smoke, don't chew tobacco, because I was from Texas. And that, you know, and don't go with girls who do, is what they would always say. I don't know. That was gross. But, you know, don't have sex. My list was a little bit longer than the other churches. Don't dance, because, you know, I've told you this before, but my church was against premarital sex, mainly because it might lead to dancing. So in order to get the blessing of God on your life, you had to do all these things, and then it was really tangible. I mean, God would make you healthy, God would make you, you know, have a good job, or God would get you, you know, in student ministry, God would get you on the team or first string, or he would put you on the cheerleading squad, whatever, if you had the blessing of God in your life. And so it was this really, it was a competition, right? To see who had the blessing of God. And if things were going wrong for you, well, what did that mean? That meant that you'd done something wrong, basically. The blessing of God was not on your life. That was my story. And if you're going to boil that down, it's basically do good, get good. If I do good stuff, I get good stuff. If I do bad stuff, I get bad stuff. It's kind of like Christian karma, right? It's like, if I do this, then it will come around for good. If I do this, it'll come around for bad. And I guess there's some truth to that. I mean, there's some in the Bible that says if we sow bad seeds, we'll get bad fruit. But that's not what we were saying when I was growing up. We were actually saying this. If I do good things, then good things necessarily have to happen to me. And if that doesn't happen, then I haven't really done anything good. I must be secretly sinning or something like that. And maybe you have understood that from church. You do good, you get good. But have you guys ever done something good and it turned out completely wrong and bad? My daughter went to outdoor school about a year ago, and she got this plant. It was a really cool plant, and they gave them to everybody, and they went home with them. And actually, the guy who taught the outdoor school said, you know what? Sometimes seniors come back to me with their plant, and they say, I kept that plant, and here it is, a really big plant. And Chloe, when she heard that, just in her mind, it just clicked, that's what I'm going to do. And her plant in her class grew bigger than everyone else's plant until one day, one of her classmates was messing with it, knocked it off of her desk, and it just was everywhere, soil and plant and everything. And she came home with it, and she was just crushed because she could see herself giving that plant. So we went into intensive care mode, all right? We put the plant in a plastic Solo cup right next to the sink where the sun could come in. We watered it. We didn't give it, I don't know how to do that. I just watered it and had sun, or I just prayed. And amazingly enough, it recovered from like a brown thing to a green thing. And it grew and grew and grew. And every once in a while, I would take it outside and I would put it on the little deck thing that we've got. And sometimes other people would put it on the deck. And I let Annie, our little Boston Terrier dog, out one day. And I stepped down onto the lower step. And somebody brilliantly had placed the cup out of eyesight. It was great. It was a great plan. And I completely crushed it. Just, and everything good that we had done, all the work, all the, we're going to do this, Chloe. Dad's your hero, Chloe. Now, instead of the source of hope, I'm the destroyer of all good things. And no dad wants to be that dad. And I was like crushed as much as I want to be all, literary right now. But anyway, I was crushed. I just couldn't believe that I was going to have to deliver this news. So I did what any dad would do. I didn't deliver the news. We just kind of, the plant went away. And we never talked about it. But now she'll know because I'm preaching about it. But anyway, in my mind, I was thinking, why? Are you kidding me? We were doing a good thing, and now bad things happen. That's a very small illustration. But have you ever tried to get involved in something, try to do a good thing, and it just blows up in your face? Do good, get good doesn't make any sense. And maybe if that's what you've understood from church, growing up, do good, get good. God's blessing is there for the taking. If you work hard enough for it, you can eventually attain it. That makes sense, and it sounds fair, and it's preached in every country. God wants me healthy and wealthy and influential. And if you aren't, if that's not happening in your life, then you must have done something wrong. So ask yourself this question. Does do good, get good work in the real world? Because if you're coming to church with that playing in the back of your mind, I can tell you two things about yourself. You are exhausted because you can't do enough good. And number two, you're disappointed. And you're disappointed in God because he's not keeping up his end of the bargain. But even if you don't believe that, even if you understand that Christians are going to suffer, even if you get that we live in a broken world and people get cancer and people get divorced and things happen that are horrible and car accidents happen, even if you get that, you're still left with the question of why? Why? What? How does this make any sense? It doesn't seem to make any sense. We're still going to suffer, and we're still left with the why questions. Well, there happens to be a person in the Old Testament that we're going to take a look at today. Her name is Hannah, and she lived exhaustion and disappointment on a daily basis. That was the story of her life. Her name is Hannah, and ironically, Hannah means grace, even though she could never seem to catch a break. She always had this thing looming over her. See, the background of Hannah's story is the tail end of the book of Judges. You've got Joshua and Judges, Joshua where they take over the land and God says, I'm going to be your God, and Judges where they kind of go through this cycle of turning away from God and then turning back to God, kind of like you and me. And then there's 1 Samuel. Now, right there in the middle, there's a book called Ruth, which is kind of the chick flick of the Old Testament. It's kind of like this little love story. It's neat, but the story of Judges goes from Judges to 1 Samuel. And in 1 Samuel, we've got this background of this nation that's been turning away from God and then turning to God. And they're coming back to God, and God is giving them one last judge by the name of Samuel. It's a time where God's really not speaking to their nation. In fact, in 1 Samuel 3, I think it's 3:1, it says that in those days, the word of the Lord wasn't heard very much. There weren't very many visions. God was sort of silent. Another thing about that generation is they pretty much did whatever they wanted to do. Judges 21:25 says, in those days, Israel had no king, and everybody pretty much did what they saw fit. They did what was right in their own eyes. And in the against that backdrop, God was telling a story. He was going to give them one last judge, a boy by the name of Samuel. So here's how the story goes. Number one, there was a man. If you have your Bibles, call it up on your device. This is 1 Samuel chapter 1. There was a man named Elkanah, who lived in Ramah in the region of Zuf in the hill country of Ephraim. Those names aren't made up. Those are real places. He was the son of Jeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuf of Ephraim. We put it up on the screen so you know that I'm not making up those names. This is basically what this is saying is there's a man named Elkanah, and he's from the hill country in Ephraim. And he's the son of this man, and the son of this man, and the son of this man. Why does he say that so many times? Because it was the duty of a man in the Old Testament, in the Israel nation, for him to produce a son. That was his job, so he could pass on his property and things like that. It was a very important thing. So, son of this man, son of this man, son of this man, and he was married. Elkanah was married. Oh, Elkanah was married too much. Elkanah had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah did not. And that's how we're introduced to the story. Hannah did not have children. And children were a tangible evidence of, remember, the blessing of God on your life. And so when people looked at Hannah, they said, oh, she doesn't have kids. But the next thought in their mind was, I wonder what her story is. I wonder what her deal is. What secret sin she's got that ended up in this situation where she does not have children. Peninnah must please God, and Hannah must be, you know, she must be hiding something. Because that's the way they lived their life. Children were the tangible evidence of God's blessing. And each year, Elkanah would travel to Shiloh, where the temple was, a sort of a structure there. It was more than a tent. And he would sacrifice to the Lord. And the priests of the Lord at the time were two sons of Eli. Hophni and Phinehas were their names. Hophni's nickname was Ferb. That's not true. Sorry. Look that up. That's not true. On the days Elkanah presented his sacrifice, he would give portions of the meat to Peninnah and her children. So get the picture. Elkanah is sacrificing, and he would bring a portion of the meat to Peninnah. In fact, a lot for her and for her kids. And though he loved Hannah, he would give her only one choice portion because the Lord had given her no children. Now, that's actually a disputed scripture. In some versions, it says he gave her a double portion, much more. Because he loved her, he gave her more, even though he knew she had no children. And that probably fueled some jealousy between Peninnah and Hannah. Now, when somebody tells you, and this happens a lot, oh yeah, you're a Christian, you believe the Bible, well, why does the Bible support things like, and they go X, Y, Z? Why does the Bible support more than one wife? That's not right. The Bible, nowhere in the Bible, supports more than one wife. In fact, every single time a plural marriage is mentioned in the Bible, it's followed by a familial disaster, all right? It's followed by, you know, like the worst Thanksgiving dinner you've ever seen. These are just dysfunctional, horrible circumstances, and Elkanah has created it for himself. He's got Hannah and Peninnah. Peninnah's got kids, Hannah does not, and Peninnah knows that Elkanah really loves Hannah. And it makes her furious. And this is what she does. This is how she reacts. So Peninnah would taunt Hannah and make fun of her because the Lord had kept her from having children. Wait, what? Who did that say had kept her from having children? It said the Lord. So Peninnah would taunt Hannah, make fun of her Because she was barren. And the Lord, because they knew the Lord's charge of everything, the Lord had made her barren. She made fun of her. From the outside looking in, to everybody in that culture, God must have been angry at Hannah. Her suffering must be connected to the fact that God was displeased with her. Or she must have done something to make him angry. Or maybe he just knew, man, she's going to be a horrible mother. So let's just keep that from happening. And that's what everybody sort of assumed. And year after the year, it was the same. Peninnah would taunt Hannah as they went to the tabernacle. And each time, it would just crush Hannah. Hannah would be reduced to tears and would not even eat. That might look familiar to a lot of you guys. Has there been a time in your life where you just lost your appetite, lost your energy, you lost everything, reduced to tears, and maybe you even just ran out of tears? Hannah has endured this not for 1 year, not for 2 years, not for 3 years, not for 4 years, but year after year as Peninnah keeps on having kids. And every year they go to the temple at Shiloh, and every year Peninnah's loading up her kids, and she's got nobody. And it seems like she's able to avoid Peninnah for most of the year, but every time they go to Shiloh, they have to camp out together. She probably calendars herself around Peninnah when they're at home, has her own separate living quarters. But on this trip, she cannot avoid it, and Peninnah is right there in her face, reminding her every day, you got nobody. You've given Elkanah no heir. You've given him no children. This has been going on for years. And Elkanah, so Peninnah is taunting her, and then Elkanah, her husband, comes on the scene, and this is what he does. Why are you crying, Hannah? Elkanah would ask. Why aren't you eating? Why be downhearted? Just because you have no children. You have me. Isn't that better than 10 sons? Oh, man, Elkanah. Come on, don't you wish, guys, that Elkanah had maybe stepped up to the plate with a little more oomph than this? This is what he comes up with. Literally, he's saying to her, what's the big deal? Have you guys ever said to your wife, it's not a big deal? How did that work for you, all right? I wish somebody would write a book that would just be, don't say it's not a big deal. That would just be one page, husband advice, don't say it's not a big deal. So, hey, no big deal. Hey, you got me. Huh? Not bad. You won the lottery when it comes to, hey, I'm better than 10 sons, you know? Oh, what an adventure in missing the point here. And I know, and by the way, I know he meant well, but how many times have you had people walk into their life that meant well? Walk into your life that meant well and said something, and it ended up being an arrow instead of what they intended it to be. You know, it just ends up hurting. And so she's got, on the one hand, Peninnah taunting her, and then Elkanah, who just can't put it together when it comes to what his wife needs at this point. So once, after the sacrificial meal at Shiloh, Hannah got up and went to pray. She'd had enough of the taunting, and she had had enough of the good intentions of her husband. Here's a quick aside. If you're married, stop relying on your spouse to meet needs that they were never designed to meet. Stop relying on them to make you happy or to fill you up in a way that would make you just feel emotionally secure and all of this stuff that only God can do. Your marriage partner was intended to make you holy, not happy. To encourage you and challenge you to be more like Christ. They don't have it in them to meet your needs. In fact, that's not the way marriage was designed anyway. God was always designed to be the one to meet your needs. And the recipe for disaster in marriage is saying all my needs are going to be met by him because he's perfect. And he's just going to do everything I ever thought he was going to do. He's going to be my Prince Charming. He's going to rub my feet and listen to me talk for hours about stuff that he does not care about, right? Or, you know, I know exactly who she's going to be. She's going to meet me at the door with a remote control and a bud, and she's going to say, baby, after you get through watching the football game, let's head back to the bedroom. Woo! It's that we're on tonight. Those people, there you go. Now we're going. See, those people don't exist. And I've told you so many times, I get sick of hearing myself say it, but when you have a marriage like that, it's like two ticks and no dog. That does not work. You cannot suck the life out of somebody else. Hannah gets this, right? And she says, okay, you're not going to meet my needs, Peninnah. You're just killing me. Elkanah, God bless your heart. I'm going to go talk to God. And that's what she did. After the sacrificial meal, she went up to pray, and Eli the priest was sitting at his customary place beside the entrance of the tabernacle, and Hannah was in deep anguish, crying bitterly as she prayed to the Lord. Notice what Hannah didn't do. She didn't put on a happy face at church. She went to church, but she said, I don't care who's watching me. This is between me and God. And she cried, and these tears were bitter. And somebody might have whispered her, especially if they were from my church tradition, you know, you really ought not be bitter today. You need to get better. You can be bitter or you can be better. And Hannah would have punched him in the face, right? She said, well, I'm bitter. And now, you know, I'm going to do my part to make you bitter. And she prays. And these are bitter tears. She's just being authentic before God. And she prays this prayer. She made this vow. O Lord of heaven's armies, if you will look down upon my sorrow and answer my prayer and give me a son, then I will give him back to you. He'll be yours for his entire lifetime. As a sign that he's been dedicated to the Lord, his hair will never be cut. Now, this is a Nazirite vow. Some people in the Old Testament have taken it. For instance, Samson and even John the Baptist in the New Testament. And so this was a vow to not touch dead things, to not drink wine or any fruit of the vine, to not cut your hair. There's a lot of things that go into this vow. Mostly it was taken by people for like a 3-month period to say, I'm going to focus on God. You guys can do your thing, but I'm going to focus on God. But she said Samuel's going to live this way his whole life. This is going to be his life. Notice this about her prayer. Her prayer is really not the prayer of a spiritual giant. It's not, oh God, you know, do your work in me and make me into the person you want me to be. No, it's basically, God, I'm desperate. Fix this. Can you fix this? I don't know if you noticed, God, but I don't have a kid. And if you'll do, and she starts bargaining with God. If you'll do this, then I'll do this. Huh? Sound good? You'll get the kid back. It's the prayer of a spiritual lightweight. Now, does God answer the prayers of spiritual lightweights? Absolutely. Yeah, he does. That's pretty much all of us are. We've got mixed motives on our best day. She's coming clean. She's right before God, and she says, God, this is the deal. This is the deal. I don't have a kid, and I want a kid, and I know you can do this. Please, I'll give him back. It's not a very theological prayer. In fact, there's a lot that's wrong in this prayer. And yet God was working in Hannah's heart, and he says, you know what? That's a prayer I can answer. In fact, that's a prayer. Let's print that prayer up and have everybody read that prayer for the next 1,000 or so years, 2,000, 3,000 years. Let's have that. I want people to know that I'm not expecting you to have everything worked out when you come to me. Just pray what's on your heart. That's what prayer is. So, see, faith is raw. Faith is ragged. It's not dressed up. Faith doesn't have anything else to dress it up. In fact, faith is the point where you've come to the end of yourself and you don't have anything else to do. Faith is exercised. When faith is exercised, it means that we've exhausted every other resource that we've got. We can live that way on a daily basis, or we can wait until we hit desperate situations. That's why we don't deepen our faith during the good times, because we don't need to. And so during the tough times, we have an opportunity to deepen our faith in God. Now, as she was praying to the Lord, Eli watched her. Eli the priest, he, by the way, was not a very good priest. Phinehas and Ferb were like horrible priests, and they were his kids, right? And they were like always messing up, and they did. You can read the story. It's just ugly. So seeing her lips moving, but hearing no sound, he thought, she's been drinking. She's drinking, of course. Must you come here drunk, he demanded. Throw away your wine. Eli's the critic. See, nobody sets out to become the critic. But it just feels right, doesn't it, sometimes? I'm just the silent observer. I'm just the one who's, they didn't do it the right way, or they didn't do it my way, or I can tell their motives are wrong. Eli, the super spiritual dude whose private life is a mess, who one day will fall off his chair and die, That's his, you know, claim to fame, I guess, in the Old Testament. That's the one thing that he did was that was of consequence. He's sitting on that same chair that he will one day fall off of, break his neck and die, and he's criticizing this woman. She's moving her lips, and he can't hear anything. This tells me two things. Probably silent prayer wasn't that well known in the tabernacle, and drinking was, because he didn't know what was going on. He said, well, she must be drunk. So easy to play the part of the critic. This happens in church, by the way. I hear people say, you know what, I think they're just all about themselves. I'm like, really? How do you know that? What sort of insight did God give you so that you know that? I've heard people, like, they watch a worship band and they'll say, you know what, I just didn't get anything out of it because it was clear that they were performing. Yeah, they were performing. Have you ever tried to get up on a stage and not perform? How, you guys would love that, right? If nobody, you know, nobody performed. I want to tell you something. I'm performing right now. I am. If I talk to you this way over lunch, you would think I'm insane, all right? If we were across from a table and I say, you know what, I've got three things I need to tell you right now. You go, I'm calling somebody. What's wrong with him? See, to say that, of course they're performing. They're doing their best. You know, Joe Bro, we watched this great musical last week, and I told a joke in staff. I said, you know what, I couldn't get anything out of that because those kids were just performing. Of course they were. They were performing. And when we get up on the stage, we're performing. But why? What's our motive? That's the key, right? And Eli thought he knew hers. Oh, she's just drunk. She's drunk. When you start questioning or judging someone else's motive, at that point, you're sort of playing God. And you really don't know. I want to do to the best of my ability what I can do. And what I do up here is hopefully get you a little off center so you question God's word and you read it. And when somebody's up here leading worship, they want to perform in such a way that points you to the God of all talent, the God of all creativity, the God who created fun and music and all of that. And it points you to him. Why? Because they're excellent at what they do. They practice at what they do. And that's godly. And when somebody runs 100 meters in a world record-breaking time, yeah, they're performing, but they cause me to worship. And when you see a great movie, those people are performing. You know what? They cause me to worship. And when you go outside and you see, you know, the sunset, that's God performing. And that's okay because he gets all the credit. But it causes me to worship. It's not a bad thing. And to sit like Eli, don't sit in Eli's seat. It's so easy. And you feel so smug when you walk out the doors. But remember, or at least ask yourself this question, during that time, did I worship or did I sit smugly and judge what was going on? It's easy to play the part of the critic. It's easy to judge from a distance. I know, and I've actually told this to somebody and they said, yes, but I can tell. I can tell when somebody's really raising their hand because they want to, and I can tell when they're raising their hand because they just want to be a show off. I'm like, really? You can? I don't think you can. And I think it would be much better if everybody just worships and says, you know, God, this is about me and you. And judging from a distance, I heard they had a divorce. I bet you I know what happened there. I mean, just from the outside looking in, I bet you I know what happened. Or their kids go off the rail. Their kids are rebellious. Oh, that must be about bad parenting because only bad parents raise kids who rebel. Yeah, right. The best parent in the world was God himself. And his two kids got so rebellious, he had to kick them out of the house, like after 8 days or so. So, yeah, good parents. So you don't know. And as a matter of fact, we're all going to be judged by the same God. So let's get rid of the Eli seat of judgment in our life. This, he goes up, throw away your wine, woman. And she says this, oh, no, sir. No, I haven't been drinking wine or anything stronger. But I am very discouraged, and I was pouring out my heart to the Lord. That's what you saw. I wasn't pouring anything into me. I was pouring out my heart to the Lord. That's what's going on. Don't think I'm a wicked woman, for I've been praying out of great anguish and sorrow. And Eli, saving face, says, well, in that case, go in peace. May the God of Israel grant the request you have asked of him. Eli, playing the part of spokesperson for God, says, you know what? There's a bigger story going on here. The God of Israel may grant what you're praying for. And she says, oh, thank you, sir. Then she got up again. She went back and began to eat again, and she was no longer sad. Let me ask you guys a question, and you can answer this one out loud. Was she pregnant at this time? You might say, I don't know, but I'll tell you, it's no. Was she pregnant? That was really weak. I just gave you the answer. Was she pregnant? No, she was not. And yet she was happy. Now, I know people who've struggled with infertility, and this is the opposite of laughing matter. It's heartbreaking, year after year after year. And yet, after all of that taunting and after all of that heartbreak, she gets up and she's no longer sad. What can we learn from that? She's not pregnant yet. She does have hope. I think she felt at that moment a connection with the God of Israel, the God who was telling a bigger story. And yeah, she was suffering, but she was a part of something bigger than herself. See, here's the story for all of it. God is telling his story, and he sometimes illustrates it with our suffering. God is telling his story, and there's no promise that you and I won't suffer. God is telling his story, and there's no promise that we won't lose people. God is telling his story, and there's no promise that we won't go bankrupt. There's no promise that we won't lose our job. There's no promise that people won't hurt us or tell lies about us. There's no promise at all. In fact, there's one promise from Jesus. He says, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart because I've overcome the world. You are going to suffer because God is telling his story, and he sometimes illustrates it with our suffering. Hannah didn't know it, but God was waiting for the perfect time to deliver this boy, to be the last judge, to do amazing things, to pick the kings, to tell the truth to the nation. He needed this boy. And it was perfect timing. God is telling his story, and he's illustrating it with our suffering. And so at that point, we have a chance to run away from God or to run to God. And it all comes down to, do we trust the storyteller? There's a great song by David Wilcox called Show the Way. He's an independent singer-songwriter. Look him up on Spotify or Pandora. He says this. He's talking to all of us. This is all of our story. Look, if someone wrote a play just to glorify what's stronger than hate, would they not arrange the stage to make it look as if the hero came too late? You're almost in defeat. It's looking like the evil side will win. So on the edge of every seat, from the moment that the whole thing begins, it is love who mixed the mortar, and it's love who stacked these stones, and it's love who made the stage here, though it looks like we're alone. In this scene cast in shadows, like the night is here to stay, there is evil cast around us, but it's love who wrote the play. And Hannah, at that moment, started trusting the storyteller. Instead of that little scene that she was in, she started seeing the big picture. And she could, from that moment, have something called joy. Now, I'm not saying she didn't struggle later on. Maybe she did. But in due time, God did give her a son. She wasn't pregnant right then. She and Elkanah eventually did have a boy and more kids. But at that moment, before any of that happened, she found joy in God. Her name means grace, and God gives us this story of grace so that we can say, you know what? My suffering may be part, is part of a bigger story. Here's the truth. God's blessing is on your life. If you're a believer right now, you've got God's blessing on your life. You don't have to strain for it. The blessing of God was Jesus Christ dying on the cross for you, pardoning you from sin, bridging the gap between you and God, and that's available for you even if you don't believe in Jesus. Even if you've been away from church for a while. The good news is this. God's blessing is on your life because he's done it already through Jesus Christ. And if you believe in him, then he's going to give you everlasting life. See, our suffering is only a faint echo of the intense suffering of Jesus on the cross. And that's the gospel. God didn't observe your suffering. He endured it. He became part of it. He's not passively watching you going, man, I don't know if they're going to be able to do this. He says, I did it for you. And one day I'm going to wrap all of this junk up and I'm going to redeem it, and it's going to be beautiful. You don't understand it now, and I don't understand how he's going to do it, but he's God, and he says he's going to do it, and I really believe that. And that gives me hope, just like Hannah walking away. That's the story of grace. When we've exhausted everything and we have been bitterly disappointed, that God can bring life out of death. You know, that plant that I stepped on, Amy took it, and she said, we're going to do something. And she took the little pieces of the plant, and she put it in this little bowl in water and put it in front of the sun. And it took a while. They died. They totally died. And then a sprout came up from the dead. I have never seen it before in my life. And we haven't put it in the dirt yet, so I'm still kind of thinking, I don't think this is going to work. But from all of that horrible destruction, life is coming. And hopefully Chloe will one day deliver that plant. I want to be there that day, by the way. It's like, it was really about me. See, that's what God does. He brings life from death, because no matter how many times we try to develop life on our own, we come up with nothing apart from God, because he came up with life in the first place. When the time is right, his story of grace gives us a chance to find life in the midst of our barrenness. God is telling his story, and he sometimes illustrates it with our suffering. And when he doesn't expect a theological response. He doesn't expect a philosophical response. He doesn't expect you to intellectualize it. He wants your response, a human response, a child's response, his child. Daddy, this is horrible. I'm hurting. Don't you see me? And you can pray in that moment the most selfish prayer you've ever prayed, and God, whose heart is a father's heart, will look into your heart and see your motive in the way that nobody else can. See your hurt in a way that no one else can. Because even though you're praying a selfish prayer, or even though you're saying why, by the way, has anyone ever told you, you know, when you're really struggling, never ask God why? See, that's one of the punch in the face moments right there. And their first question would be, why? It's like, don't ask. Don't ask why. I just did it. Listen, if you want to ask God, what's the point of that? Smoke screening God and saying, I really don't want to ask why, and I know that you can't read my heart. No, if you want to ask why, ask why. God's big enough to handle your why. He wants your response. And no matter what your response is, it's a response of faith. If you're calling out to him, Hannah's response was a response of faith, of trust. How would that change your view of your own suffering? How about that ticket of just being able to say to God whatever is on your heart? How about that freedom to just say, God, this is who I am. You know me anyway, so I'm just going to be me for a second. I don't even know. Some people might even say, I don't even know whether I believe in you. And I'm calling out to you. I don't even know whether I want to be a part of what you're doing, but I'm calling out to you. I'm hurt so much by people in church that I don't ever want to go back to church, but I'm calling out to you. That's the response of faith and trust. How could that change your life? If it didn't depend on what you got, but it still instead depended on the fact, oh, wait, I'm a part of a bigger story. God is telling his story, and sometimes he illustrates it with my suffering, and that's okay, because one day he's going to use my suffering to tell something glorious, bigger than me. So that's okay because of what he did for me through Jesus and how he's going to wrap everything up and he's going to make it beautiful again. God is telling his story, and he sometimes illustrates it with our suffering.